that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And a happy Monday to you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 959 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 3 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, barring there's no impeachment process, which increasingly could become likely if Democrats are elected. And wouldn't that be a fine thing? There's a lot happened today. The Republicans, Bill Frist, has decided that the most important issue facing America is gay marriage. So they're going to be debating that in the Senate today, trying to come up with the very best sound bites to use in their commercials and to feed to the news services tonight and get the base all whipped up. And then, of course, flag burning. They got to talk about flag burning. People are starving. People are dying. People are hungry. We have a war going on, or we have an occupation going on. I'd say we don't have a war going on. There's not a country that we're fighting against, but we have an occupation going on. And in the meantime, here domestically, the United States is melting down. Our economically, the middle class is getting poorer, the wealthy are getting wealthier, and not a good time for our country. But gay marriage is what's really important, right? Andrew Bernstein is with us. He's the author of The Capitalist Manifesto. He specializes in Ayn Rand's work, Objectivism, Capitalism, and Business Ethics, over at AynRand.org, the Ayn Rand Institute. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Good to be back, Tom.
Andrew, you recently wrote a piece about price gouging, and this is something that I think this really hits home for a lot of Americans right now as they dig deep down into their wallets to come up with more money to pay for gasoline. You suggest that price gouging cannot be objectively defined and therefore should not be a crime. My question would be, should price gouging be a crime in a monopolistic industry?
Well, I think on a free market, I think there's no possible way to gain a monopoly. The only way to gain a monopoly is by government interference in the economy, by government giving a franchise to some company and then legally debarring competition. So on a free market, there's no way to get a monopoly. I think what we have today is the competition is certainly not a monopoly in the oil industry. I think the key point, Tom, is that's the moral right of any individual to sell something that he owns at any price that he thinks fit.
So do you think that Bill Gates should not be able to allow me to make a copy of Microsoft's operating system?
I'm sorry, there's traffic here. What did you say about Bill Gates?
Do you think that he should not be able to allow me, by force of law, to make a copy of Windows?
I think if, I'm not sure I got the question, but
I wanted to bootleg a copy of Windows and sell it, do you think that that's legally and morally ethical or unethical?
Oh, I think that's immoral. I think that's dishonest. I mean, if he has a patent rights or a copyright on the material, then it belongs to Microsoft, not to somebody else.
But the copyright is a creation of law. I mean, he can create, like, if I create a piece of art, I can sell you the piece of art. But, you know, you now own it, not me. If Bill Gates makes something and he sells it to me, don't I now own it?
Yes. Yeah, if he sells
it. Then why can't I make a copy of it and sell it to you?
I see the question, because as I understand the terms of the deal, the terms of the sale are that you will not do that. Those are the conditions under which they agree to sell and under which you agree to buy. That you recognize morally that the copyrights belong to the company
you're talking about using the force of law to establish a monopoly on a product, and that monopoly is called copyrights or patents. You know,
I wouldn't refer to that as a monopoly, Tom. I would say that somebody has the moral right to their intellectual and bodily work. You know, like if I teach a class and make enough money to buy a car, then that car belongs to me
learn something in your class, does my knowledge belong to you?
No, but that's not. But we're talking about, like, if Edison puts in all this work to develop the electric lighting system, then certainly he should have the right to benefit from that. That's the moral basis of patent laws.
Well, then let's get it back to natural monopolies. For water, for example, you say that there's, you know, that the free market will solve all problems. I'm assuming that you believe that water should all be privatized. Private corporations should be supplying our water.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay, how is that not a monopoly? I mean, I've got one water pipe coming into my house.
Yeah, but that's not the only source of water on a free market. I mean, if some private company wants to charge you rates above what you want to pay for the water, there's other means of getting water on a free market. I mean, you can buy it. You can buy bottled water. If somebody in some local area is charging rates beyond what the consumers want to pay for water or anything else, all he's doing is inviting competition. The whole history of capitalism shows how many entrepreneurs will come in and compete with somebody who's charging rates above what the consumers are willing to pay.
Except none of those people have a pipe coming into my house. Here, this is from the Los Angeles Times. Tim Reiterman wrote this. In San Gerardo, a tidy but poor farmworking community encircled by the black earth of Salinas Valley fields, residents have been drinking bottled water for almost 5 years because the tap water they buy from a private company is unsafe. Nearby families in the modest town of Chular are still smarting over monthly water charges that in some instances ballooned by 1,000% or more. And about 40 miles to the northwest, the Santa Cruz Mountains hamlet of Felton voted last year to tax each household up to $700 a year to take control of the local for-profit water system after the new for-profit owner proposed a series of rate increases.
Yeah, well, what happens? But don't forget the government grants franchises to utilities. What happened on a free market is that there'd be competing utility companies, including water companies, and just the same way on the free market, there's competing bakeries and there's competing grocery stores, there's competing auto manufacturers.
But I can go out and visit as many grocery stores as I want. If I turn the tap in my house, there's only one pipe connected to my house.
No, I understand, but you have a choice. You would have a choice amongst competitors, and if company X charged rates too high, they know that you could switch to company Y.
How?
What do you mean how?
There's a water pipe coming into my house.
Yeah, but there'd be different suppliers of water on a free market.
Through the same pipe?
Consequently, if companies charge too high a price, you could simply go to the competitors. Just like you could rewire your telephone so you could redo the network of pipes. We have the technology to do that, Tom. The point is that on a free market, any company knows they have competitors. They can't.
Well, I agree with you, Andy Bernstein, that we have the technology to define digitally what data is going to flow over a pair of copper wires. Although there's still the issue of the ownership of the copper wires. But I don't think that we have the technology for five water companies to feed water into a water system and for me to select the molecules of water from one of those particular companies coming out of
the tap. That's not the point. I think it is the point.
If you have competing
water companies, company X, Y, and Z in the New York area, then the customers have the choice who they go with, and the providers, the producers, know that they have to satisfy their customers because they have competitors. You have to open the marketplace up to competition in order to keep prices down. It's the only way you're going to keep prices down. And
that's why I think we should do away with the patenting.
They had a legal monopoly. That's why they were able to charge such rates. It's the same thing with water companies or gas companies or electric companies.
Well, this brings us back to my point, and that is that there are things where there are natural monopolies. The fire department, there's a natural monopoly. The water pipe coming into your house is a natural monopoly. The power grid, the electricity that comes into my home, it's a natural monopoly. And where a natural monopoly exists, it's possible for somebody to exploit that and rip off people who have no choice but to make use of whoever controls that natural monopoly, and therefore there should be laws against price gouging.
No. I already answered that. But the point about the oil companies is there's certainly no monopoly on oil. There is competition in the oil industry, and to say that a gas company or a gas station owner can't charge the price that he wants is basically socialism. You're saying you have the moral right to own your property.
Well, first of all, most of the retail gasoline sold in the United States is sold by the companies who are also pumping it and refining it. So they have a monopoly all the way down the road. And the retailers, if a retailer decides that they're going to stand up to the oil companies, this happened to a retailer in Vermont when I lived there. He charged less than the oil company was selling to him. They took away his franchise. They put the guy out of business.
I don't know that instance. It's certainly their right to do so. I mean, that would be...
That's right, because they've created a natural monopoly. Well, actually, I'd say they've created an illegal monopoly.
There's competition. There's Exxon, there's Mobil,
there's four companies.
They're in competition with each other. The reason why we have such high gas prices is not because of a monopoly. It's because of government interference in the economy. We're not allowed to drill oil on the OCS. We're not allowed to drill oil on animals. We're not allowed to build nuclear power plants. We're not allowed to build new refineries. When you decrease supply relative to demand, prices are going to go up. That's economics 101.
Okay, Andrew Bernstein, andrewbernstein.net. Ayn Rand.org also. Andrew Bernstein, thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, coming up on today's program, don't miss in our next hour, in our second hour, Greg Palast is going to be here in the studio with his new book, Armed Madhouse. Our quote for the day, nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. This is from Abraham Lincoln. Well, the Republicans in the Senate certainly have power. This is, you know, the fact that this is going on in the Senate, and I'm talking with Andrew Bernstein about price gouging, I think that it creates this really important contrast. And there really are a series of important issues out there. And I think that one of the things that is most important is that we all learn how to discuss these things with each other. All of us have conservatives in our lives. All of us have people, you know, whether they're in our work or in our family or socially, with whom we politically disagree. And my goal with this program is to help you not only win the water cooler wars, that is, know how to have these debates, how to have these arguments with these folks in ways that you can actually make your point, but also when all is said and done, there's no blood on the floor. You know, you don't end up calling people names and beating them up and you know, cut his mic. Oh, you've had your 15 seconds of, you know, the Bill O'Reilly stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, we don't need that. But I think we do need the debates. And I think that the debates are an important and healthy thing. That said, privatizing water is the big thing coming down the road. I shared with you the story of the communities in California that were seeing prices go up a thousand percent. The community in Felton that just taxed each household $700 to take control of their own water system, to buy it back from a company to whom they had privatized it. Tim Reiterman notes, in the late 19th century, private companies delivered water to most of the state's homes and businesses. Today, about 80% of the state's people, this is California, live in large cities and towns served by publicly owned utilities. And the publicly owned utilities just makes sense. In wherever there's a natural monopoly, it just makes sense. It's why we should have publicly owned power, in my opinion. And if the private companies want to get into the power business, great. Let them sell me a system to put on my roof to generate my own personal electricity. I mean, there's an incredible opportunity here for private companies to compete with publicly owned companies. And if some company can come up with some way for me to convert the water or the river that I live on, my house actually floats on the river, so it'd be pretty easy. All I have to do if I want water is put a hose into the river, but it's not, you know, I mean, rivers in America these days, you don't want to drink right straight out of them. If they can figure out a way to turn that into tap water, cool. I wouldn't have to buy it from the city. But, you know, until they do, probably somebody has, but it's sure it's not all that economical. But the point is that there are natural utilities or natural monopolies out there, and those natural monopolies do tend to define prices. And when we turn the natural monopolies over to private corporations, we put ourselves at risk. We put ourselves at peril. Over the weekend, one of the news programs did a special on people who are being taken advantage of by custodians. There's this whole fad streak, whatever, in the United States right now, where where it's not as much a fad. It's a necessity, I guess, in many cases, where elderly people, courts are assigning custodians to elderly people, that is, legal custodians, not people who come in and, you know, give them a bath and things. These are people who take care of their finances. And these custodians, in many cases, are coming in and going, oh, you've got $300,000 in the bank? My brother-in-law is in the business of remodeling houses, and we're going to remodel your kitchen for $50,000. And the elderly person with Alzheimer's goes, oh, okay, with me, and just signs the paper. And these custodians are like just ripping people off all over the country. Well, that's the private marketplace at work. And so a lot of states, there's only four states that even regulate them. And even in those four states, it's harder to get a hairdresser's license than it is to get a custodian's license. And so a lot of states are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to do something about this. The problem with free market solutions to everything is that the free market solution only kicks in after the damage has been done. And it just doesn't work. Mark in Livermore, California. Hey, Mark, we have... I'm going to have to take you after the break here because my phone is not set up where I can click you on. And we do have a break coming up. But the bottom line here is that without we the people getting involved collectively, without all of us participating and saying, you know, collectively we're going to work on this thing and we're going to own the water system. We're going to make sure that we're not preyed upon. It doesn't work. I mean, laissez-faire capitalism, the idea of let the buyer beware in all cases, in all circumstances, in all situations, makes sense for a small community. You know, if there's a bad doctor practicing medicine, everybody knows about it really fast in a little town. But when you get into larger communities or you get into companies that can easily move from place to place and maintain their anonymity, then it's important that we have protections from predators. And that form of protection is government. And government, you know, and if we participate in that government, which we more of us need to be doing, then that government becomes us. It becomes we the people. So we'll be taking your calls on this and other topics, a lot in the news today as well. And right after this break, 27 minutes past the hour, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
Wake up and shake it up, America.
From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea.
Our government is a fine for we, the people who can't ignore
that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Speaking of reaping what we sow, the Army Manual. The Army Manual is now going to delete, it's going to eliminate the language that says that we cannot engage in humiliating and degrading treatment of prisoners. What this means is that every other country in the world is going to say, okay, we can do that too, and any American military taken prisoner in the future will have no safety and no protection. It's like they're institutionalizing the stuff that led to Haditha. They're institutionalizing the stuff that led to the death of people in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan and in the prisons of Iraq at Abu Ghraib. They're institutionalizing this stuff. Oddly enough, apparently the State Department is opposed to this, although we don't know. Maybe that's just posturing. Maybe that's just for the media. And as the Guardian in the United Kingdom says, a Marine's wife paints portrait of U.S. troops out of control in Haditha. The Marine unit involved in the killing of Iraqi civilians in Haditha last November had suffered a total breakdown in discipline and hard drugs and alcohol problems. Had drug and alcohol problems, according to the wife of one of the battalion's staff sergeants. The allegations are out in the new issue of Newsweek magazine. And says the Guardian contribute to an ever more disturbing portrait of embattled Marines under high stress, some on their third tour of duty after ferocious door-to-door fighting in the Sunni insurgent strongholds of Fallujah and Haditha. Incredible. She says there's problems in Kilo Company with drugs, alcohol, hazing, violent initiation games, you name it. She said, I think it's more than possible that these guys were totally tweaked out on speed or something when they shot those civilians in Haditha. Tragic. And yeah, and what nobody is willing to say in the mainstream media, and I will say, is this should be at the doorstep of George W. Bush, who, by the way, should not be sitting in the Oval Office right now. The most important story of the year, certainly, and I would say probably the most important political story in the history of the United States, is over at RollingStone.com by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Was the 2004 election stolen? And I think we can safely say now the answer is unambiguously yes. Salon.com attempted to debunk Robert Kennedy's story. Now Harvey Wasserman and Bob Fitrakis over at freepress.org have debunked the debunking, although that has not shown up on Think Progress yet. This is really tragic that Think Progress would highlight the Salon.com article in a way that suggests that Salon were the real journalists here. But the article, go over to RollingStone.com and read this thing. You can find it at CommonDreams.org as well. This article by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Just laying out chapter and verse of how the Republicans stole Ohio. And as Greg Palast would say, or Mark Crispin Miller would say, and they're fixing to do it here too. I mean, it's coming up next. Let's try this again. Mark in Livermore, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. In regards to, like, public utilities and corporations taking over utility control and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken, almost every utility deregulation in the country since the 80s has been for the benefit of the corporations involved and not for the customers that invariably get hit with higher rates.
Mm-hmm.
I live in California, so I got the brunt of the energy deregulation.
Yeah, and we got it here too in Oregon.
Yeah, the process that the energy deregulation went through was written by the utility companies.
Right. In fact, it was written by Enron. It was written by Ken Lay.
Well, it was written by the corporation that owns PG&E and the two other majors that are in the state. And they didn't act on the provisions that they themselves agreed to when the deregulation process was started.
Right. Right. Yep. Well said. Mark, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Tony in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tom. I was just about the when you were discussing the monopoly issues with the Ayn Rand guy, mm-hmm. You mentioned that if you buy a piece of artwork, you own it. And it's not entirely true. If you buy a painting, you own the physical painting, but you cannot copy that and then sell copies of that.
But my point is that that's not because of any natural law. That's because people who make paintings got together and got a law passed by Congress that says that they're going to modify the rules of the natural rules of ownership. I mean, what boggles my mind is that folks who say, oh, we're in favor of the free market, we're in favor of the natural market. Well, in the free and natural market, if you make something and you sell it to somebody, they now own it. And they say, no, we're going to establish a government rule, a government policy, where the government will act as is essentially the guarantor of my ownership. In other words, if I create a piece of art, and I have, books are art, right? Literature.
Right, exactly.
So I create a piece of art, and I sell it to you, but I retain the copyright. So now you make a photocopy of it and sell it to somebody else. I have the legal right to go to the government and say, I want you to enforce my ownership of that thing, even though I don't physically own it anymore, right? I sold it to him. I want you to enforce my ability to continue getting royalties from him. And, I would suggest that turns me into, as Dean Baker would say, a nanny state lover.
So. Well, I think this whole idea of you look at natural law, and it's not necessary, this idea that somehow magically natural law will result in this world that we would like to have.
That's silly, but B, the larger point is that the folks who advocate for a free market really don't want a free market. They want a highly regulated market. They just want it regulated in ways that control the producers and the owners of wealth. And that includes things like copyright and patent law. I mean,
I think that they might also be in favor of just complete, anarchy as far as the rules that govern them. And not, you know, because
no,
they acquire power, they acquire money, and the more money they acquire, the more money they can acquire.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that they, you know, well, Andrew Bernstein was still defending copyright and patent laws. And Thomas Jefferson wrote against these things. He said, you know, let somebody have a copyright or a patent for up to 3 years. You know, long enough for them to get back some, the initial value. But after 3 years, say, hey, you know, it's not yours anymore. Sorry. And, you know, gee, that makes a certain amount of sense to me. As somebody who actually, you know, I get royalty checks from publishers for books that came out a long time ago. And it still makes sense to me. We're gonna get Dean Baker on here to talk about this at some length. There's this thing called the Creative Commons copyright. There's a whole new way of looking at copyrights and patents, and I'm not sufficiently conversant in it to be able to argue it right at this moment, but I want to get Dean Baker on to talk about it. But anyhow, it's an interesting issue you raised, Tony, and I thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Jerry in Sonora, California. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, Tom. Great show, by the way. I love it. You got the best one out there.
Thank you.
I wanted to see if you... there was an article in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, about, if I'm not mistaken, about 5 months ago, and I probably cut it out and got it somewhere because I'm got a bad habit of doing that, but it was discussing how the oil companies, all of the oil companies together, have put their raw product in one big sort of like a vat. They know that they're all drawing from this one common pool.
Right,
and
it's the concept
their,
of
they
it's
add
the concept
their own
of,
stuff to it, you know.
Yeah, it's the concept of fungibility.
Yeah,
a little bit goes down here, a little bit more comes up over here, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and they control the price of the oil, I mean, of our gasoline that way, you know.
Right.
One of them sees that Chevron's drawing out, suppose Shell does, then they go, oh, well, they're taking out of my pool, so I'm going to raise the price of my gas, and they all raise it at the same time.
Right.
And we have no more gas wars like we used to have. So
right, but what we do have is an invoice from the late 80s, or excuse me, an internal company memo inside the oil industry where they said, you know, we not be building new gasoline refineries, but we need to be taking some of the gasoline refineries we have offline because we have too much refinery capacity and it's keeping prices low. And
yeah.
And we now, since that memo was written, there have been 50 refineries taken offline in the United States.
I know. It's absolutely atrocious.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep up the good work, Tom.
Thank you, Jerry.
Bye.
Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Smitty in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Smitty.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for everything. Well, I got two questions. With all the things that's going on with the president, one question is he ever be charged for war crimes? And the second question is, with everything that he's done, can we get rid of all the judges he's put on the Supreme Court?
Well, in answer to question two, I wish, but I don't think that there's going to be any way, even if we can demonstrate that he is the illegitimate president. In terms of being charged with war crimes, there are a lot of investigations that need to be done before we could have that conversation. But,
yeah, but all I'm saying is that since his presidency is not really legitimate,
right?
Doesn't the people that he's put up on the bench, doesn't that take away everything? I mean, the legitimacy of those people that's been put in place.
I think morally it does, Smitty, and I would agree with you on that. I suspect legally it won't. I mean, if a court were to convene and if they were to determine that the Republicans actually stole the election in 2004. As John F. or Robert F. Kennedy Jr. lays out in all the evidence in the RollingStone.com article. By the way, today is the anniversary of the assassination of his father. Robert Kennedy Sr. was shot today. He died tomorrow back in, what, 67, as I recall? And
68, one, I think, wasn't
68,
it?
Yeah, whatever year it was.
It's
today. In any case, even if Bush was prosecuted for that and convicted, I don't think that that's going to change the fact that these guys are sitting on the Supreme Court. I wish I was wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I'm not an expert on these things. We'll look into it. But the first thing we've got to do is investigate this stuff. Let's get some serious investigations from some serious organizations. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When your war is found to be based on lies and your approval ratings dive, don't you want somebody to hate? Yeah, you need somebody to hate. Come this November, it's probably too late. Bush better find somebody to hate.
Oh, he already has, actually. There they are. They're out there. And right now, in fact, Bill Frist on Fox News Sunday was asked, you know, is this really the most serious issue?
Aren't gay marriage and flag burning the most important issues the Senate can be addressing in June of 2006?
Right now, there's no prioritization there. Securing America's values, and I hope...
Yeah, securing America's values, Bill Frist. Amazing. Gary in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Yep.
Last week, you were talking about a Supreme Court decision that came down that I think maybe, if I understand correctly, restricted the rights of people to speak out.
If they work for the government and if their job is to blow the whistle on wrongdoing, they can now be punished for speaking out. Yes.
Okay, the reason I'm asking, I was reading the Rolling Stone article and it was mentioning how a couple people who had spoken out had been fired when they tried to report fraud. I'm wondering if that's maybe what their intention was to apply it to the next election in November.
Yeah, this recent Supreme Court decision from a week or so ago, where the Supreme Court essentially said, this was the case of the Los Angeles, a prosecuting attorney in Los Angeles had pointed out that a police officer lied in order to get a search warrant, which is a crime. And when the district attorney said that, he was demoted by his boss. He was penalized by his boss for pointing out that a cop had lied. And so he sued, and he said, you can't do this. I was just doing my job. My job is to, you know, point out. And the Supreme Court said, no, they can do this. And so now whistleblowers inside the government, inside federal or state government or local government, for that matter, have no legal protections any longer. They can be destroyed, their career-wise, by their superiors.
What it would apply to election officials, people watching?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it just common sense says it would.
That's what I'm thinking at the motive is. That's all it's wearing.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah. Gary, thanks a lot. I think so, too. In fact, the whole point of getting John Roberts on the court and getting Sam Scalito on the court was to be able to get these kinds of pro-fascist and other pro-corporate decisions passed. I mean, it's, you know, take apart women's rights, take apart individual rights, take apart individual liberties, take apart the protective nature of the government, and use the government merely as a tool, a very blunt tool at that, to protect the wealth and power of those at the top. Bonnie in Sacramento. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. I love your show. I'm calling about our primary tomorrow for Secretary of State.
Yes.
Which goes right into the the Palace, Kennedy, and Mark Crispin Miller thing. Senator Bowen has been actively campaigning for over a year for this position.
Yes, in fact, she's done so on this program.
And, well, I just want to get that word out over and over again.
Yep.
She, you know, clean elections, safeguarding our elections, fighting difficulty with registrations in
yes.
Los Angeles. She's the first senator in the state to have an email address. I just found that out. I was doing a little more research besides the phone banking I've been doing for the last few weeks for her. This woman knows elections backwards and forwards. She has had everyone that knows anything in to testify at the hearings that she has held as the chairperson for the Elections Committee.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, Bonnie, and I think that she would make a great Secretary of State. And Deborah Bowen, she's a good person. She's been a good senator, and she would make a great Secretary of State. And folks who are listening on the radio stations in California that this program is carried on, and on Sirius Satellite Radio in California, and you know, on the web or whatever, however you may be listening to the program, if you're in California, get out and vote tomorrow. I mean, whatever you have to do, get to your polling places. And then also, I'm very interested to hear from people, you know, on Wednesday who voted on Tuesday in the California elections about what your experience was like voting, particularly before you go to the polls. Read this piece by Robert Kennedy about the strategies and tactics Republicans are employing to suppress the vote. And, you know, I'd love to hear from folks about, you know, what happened with that. We'll be talking, in fact, in the next hour with Greg Palace. We'll get into some of this stuff. But, Bonnie, thank you for the call, and thanks for the plug for Deborah Bowen.
Thank you.
Good Bye. Talking to you. Joe in Toms River, New Jersey. Hey, Joe.
Okay.
Hello? No, Joe's not there. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Tom?
Yes.
All that you're talking about today, I just couldn't wait to get through. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure.
The question is, what kind of a in Allegheny County, we only had a 24% turnout for these local and local elections. What kind of turnout did you have?
Here in Oregon, I think we had around 34-35%, something like that. It was
okay,
very low. We have vote by mail, so it's very easy
to
vote here. Yeah.
Okay,
everybody in the state votes by mailing in a ballot.
Where's the outrage for the American people here? We have $280 billion deficit, a surplus.
I think the outrage, Gary, is going to show up in the general election. I don't think that people view primaries.
You sure about that?
Yeah. I can't say that I'm sure about it. No, but
you
I
have your doubts, though, don't you?
Well, my point is that I don't think that the low
turnout. The
question
was, though, Tom, you personally have some doubt here, don't you? Legitimate doubt.
About what?
About whether the rest of the American people get it.
Oh, no. There's no doubt in my mind, Gary, that the majority of American people don't get it. The majority of American people are not registered voters.
Well, they better step up to the plate. They put this guy in.
Well, they will do it as they wake up. I mean, we have two problems.
What's it going to take, though? What's it going to take?
We have three problems. We have number one, we have an education system that's broken. Number two, you got people working so hard that they don't have time to pay attention to politics. Number three, you've got a media which is totally captive of huge multinational corporations, you know, including large defense contractors who really don't want us to be politically active. We have to figure out ways to cut through all of that. And I'd say, number one, get involved with a political party or a local political action group, democracyforamerica.com, or your local Democratic Party, and start knocking on doors. Start talking to people. 57 minutes past three.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Palantir. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, White Rose Society.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and on CRM Digital on cable TV systems in 29 states. Welcome back to our program. Greg Palast is here with us in the studio. His new book, Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child Left Behind, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Greg Palast, welcome.
It's actually No Child Behind Left. See, I have to translate what the president really means when he declares war in the classroom, you know?
Yeah. Well, you've done a great job of it here, Greg. And Greg, of course, the author of the best-selling book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, as well as many other things, some brilliant BBC documentaries. You did probably the most solid reporting that I've seen anywhere on the 2000 election. And the BBC...
Are you had a problem with my 2004 reporting?
No, we'll get to that in a second. But, you know, by way of setup, in the 2000 election, you did a piece for the BBC, which everybody in the United Kingdom saw.
Yeah.
Most people in Europe saw.
Yeah.
Everybody
Latin
in
America
Australia
can.
Saw. People all over, you know, South America. You know, all around the world, people saw this. Was it an hour long, half hour long? It was.
We start out first with the print and the Guardian papers with the 14-minute top of the news, you know, top of the nightly news, in which I explained that Al Gore won. Because just before the 2000 election, Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, not satisfied with the old form of democracy where everyone votes, scrubbed thousands and thousands of black voters off the voter rolls.
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Actually, they targeted 94,000. We finally got the actual tapes. Scrubbed these black voters off the voter rolls, called them felons, not allowed to vote, but, of course, their crime was voting while black.
Right.
And by the way, the end of that story was that Jeb Bush actually signed an apology and consent decree that he wouldn't do it again.
Oh, really?
And he did it again, but that's a quibble, right? I'm sorry. So he said, I'm sorry, after he just returned the tux from the inaugural from his brother. But that, you know, that wasn't the end of it. So that was, yes, so we busted that report. And by the way, we actually, I do investigative reporting for those who don't know Greg Palaszczuk, BBC. Investigative reporting, you know, it's not allowed under Patriot Act 3 in the United States.
But you can learn all about it at GregPalaszczuk.com.
Right, right. Yeah, Greg Palaszczuk. So we actually went in and got the computer disks from Harris's office, cracked the codes, and found those lists and found out who were these felons who weren't felons.
Right. Yeah. So in the 2000 election, mm-hmm. you demonstrated that George W. Bush lost Florida. And this was before the New York Times took a year, you know, the consortium of newspapers to prove
right.
that Bush
We put
didn't
out the story when the count was still on. Gore was still in the race.
Right, right. So, and that story did not run in the United States. No American media, to the best of my knowledge,
well, for good reasons,
picked that story up.
Come on. We don't want that stuff to get out in the United States. We don't want people to think that we've had that in 2000 was an electoral coup d'etat.
What? Our democracy isn't a democracy?
And, you know, I mean, you have to understand, my sister paper, The Guardian, The Washington Post, my ABC television, BBC offered ABC television our tapes of the theft of the election.
Right.
For nothing. I guess the price was too high. They wouldn't run it.
Incredible.
They just refused.
So now here we have the 2004 election.
Yeah.
And once again, you looked into the theft of an election.
That's right.
Robert Kennedy has just brought this to a high profile by publishing a piece in Rolling Stone.
Celebrity white guys to get the word out for us.
Well,
thanks,
you know,
Bob. No, actually, he's great. I was on his
absolutely. You know, I mean, unfortunately, that's the reality of the day.
Yeah.
And I wrote a piece for Common Dreams about it, saying, you know, this guy has a name that the mainstream media can't ignore. And so, you know, in fact, my piece in Common Dreams mentions you. And clicks to your book. But the point is that in Armed Madhouse, Greg Palaszczuk's new book.
Get your slice later.
my 35 cents, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In Armed Madhouse, Greg Palaszczuk's new book, there is a chapter about the theft of the 2004 election.
Right,
and what
it's
called
Carry One and Now Get Over It.
Right, right.
Because they're going to steal, because they're putting 2008 in their pocket.
And what you discovered was that 2004 was stolen by George W. Bush as well.
Yeah, I mean, and that was much wider, much nastier piece of work. I mean, you have to understand, 3.6 million votes, over 3 million votes, were cast and never counted in the United States.
In 2004.
This is not the Ukraine, the United States, in 2004.
And that represents what percentage of the total?
Okay, you're only talking about, you know, like 4 or 5% of the total. But most elections are decided within that margin. And we know that, therefore, yes, they shoplifted Ohio with that group of uncounted votes, but also New Mexico, Iowa, and several other states, and it's getting bigger. And so one of the things that we did in BBC investigation, by the way, I did write two days before the election for the Guardian papers, where I have George Orwell's old column, we did an investigation.
Literally?
Yeah. And we have, yeah, I do. And I'm sure he'd be
pleased. Impressed.
And he would.
He would be, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, he'd say, oh, my God, that bald guy Palaszczuk. But
he's great.
2 days before the election, we wrote a piece, Ohio, the next Florida. Yeah. And then I got a call from the New York Times afterwards, after we did report on BBC Kerry won, but he won't get inaugurated under the American system. Yeah. And the New York Times called me up and then wrote me an email saying, we want to interview you about the theory that Bush lost. And question one was, are you a sore loser? Okay. Question two was, are you a conspiracy nut?
Honest to God.
Question three was nothing. That was the entire interview.
These
New York Times
the questions
investigation.
From New York Times.
New York, I have it. I have it in writing actually from them. I mean, this is the New York Times deep investigation of what happened to the 3 million missing votes in America in 2004. And part of it, by the way, you'll see, because we have a lot of documents actually that I put in our madhouse so you can, you know, because I feel kind of like Joe McCarthy. I've got documents here.
Right. But communists in the State Department.
Right, but unlike McCarthy, I actually have the documents, so I show them.
Right.
Right. And so one of the things we got out of the Republican National Committee headquarters computers, emails between the top honchos attached to lists which they call caging lists, which were the program, unreported in the United States, of mass challenge of black voters. I mean, literally, well, we got about 50,000, 60,000 names of black voters from just one state. It was national.
Yeah, in fact, they had the mighty Texas Strike Force.
Right, and so and you have to understand, so for massive challenge of voters, and this was not felons this time, this was so-called suspect addresses,
mm-hmm.
so they could challenge voters. And who are its suspects? Page after page of African-American soldiers sent overseas. Now, by the way...
Out of Ohio.
Out of Ohio, Florida. I mean, you have to understand they did this in like a dozen swing states, Wisconsin.
And the way this worked was they would then send a letter to the home of these soldiers.
Right.
Had to be signed for in order to take receipt of. The soldier's not there, can't sign for it. So the letter goes back to the elections office. The elections office then says, aha, this person isn't legally at this residence.
Well, what was happening is the RNC was sending it out itself in many cases. And then they would go to the elections officials, their elections officials, like Ken Blackwell, who is not only Secretary of State of Ohio, but...
And say, here's the bounced piece of mail.
Yeah.
See, and take this guy off the list.
Take the guy off the list. He's got a suspect address.
Then,
or if they show up on election day... Someone challenges them, and then they get what's called a provisional ballot, which is a brand new gimmick that was put into place for the 2004 election.
And those didn't even get counted at all.
No, we had 1.1 million people were hit with these back-of-the-bus ballots. Over 500,000 of them were simply thrown away and not counted.
Literally simply thrown away.
Literally simply thrown away.
Why?
Because it's up to the see, after I did the voter purge story of 2000, members of the Congressional Black Caucus are really shaken up, so they went and they demanded the White House create a system and a new law that would allow voters who showed up to polls without their names on the registries to vote anyway. Mm-hmm. And then they check the registration. If you're a legal voter, they count your ballot.
Right.
They should have realized as soon as Karl Rove said, that's a great idea, they should have backed off right away because he knew what he was going to do. They shunted over 1 million people to these ballots. And the law... By the way, it's called Help America Vote Act.
Right.
There's a signal right there. As soon as Bush tells you he's going to help you vote,
yeah.
Look out.
It's like he's going to clean up the skies. He's going to save
right.
the forest.
He's helping us vote, George Bush. Uh-oh. And so what happened was, why am I laughing? But you have to laugh if you cry. What happened was is that the law says that you must give every one of these challenge voters a provisional ballot, but the law does not say that you have to count the vote, that you have to check it or do anything with it. It's completely up to each Secretary of State. And the Secretary of State of Ohio, of Colorado, swing states, were also chairmen and chairwomen of the Bush reelection campaign.
So they just decided not to count the ballots.
Yeah.
We're not going
to count
the ballots.
You don't have to count the ballots.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible.
And that was just, that was the beginning of it. And we just, if you're a black voter, the chance your vote won't count. 900% higher than if you're a white voter. That statistic?
Yeah, that's, welcome to the Republican incarnation of America. And hopefully we can take it back. The question I want to ask you when we come back, Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, his new book, Armed Madhouse. What can we do about this? And I want to get into some of the other topics you talked about in your book here, too. Osama bin Laden and such. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Show.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anyone can hack the files and push delete. You see no proof, and I got no receipt. Let's get the system under control, and the final results will match the exit poll. They lost my vote. It isn't fair. I took the stand. Doesn't anybody care? They lost my vote.
Welcome back, my friends. Yeah, they lost my vote. Here in Oregon, we have vote by mail. I don't think they lost my vote. We've got a Secretary of State who is just absolutely, totally a good guy, Bill Bradbury. Really a good guy. But we still have, even though we're filling out paper ballots and sending them in, they're still being counted by machines that are being sold to us by Chuck Hagel's old company, ES&S.
Yeah, the other problem is we had absentee ballots because people are scared of computer voting. The guys they thought would fix the voting machines, they said, so they mailed them their ballot.
Yeah.
A lot of Democrats, in places like, for example, Palm Beach, where Teresa Lepore finally came out of the closet as a Republican, finally.
Mm-hmm. And said enough. Talking with Greg Palast, by the way. Greg Palast is the author of Armed Madhouse, his new book, and his website, GregPalast, PALAST.com, for more information. Greg?
Yeah. And Lepore counted more votes than there were in absentee ballots. So she had counted more absentee votes than there were absentee ballots. In other words, if you're going to jigger the election...
So it was the flip side. So so in Ohio, they just don't count them at all.
Right.
And in Florida, they say,
have a little extra. But, so you just have to trust those guys to open your letter and count it. But
Well, we've... Okay. With regard to... Just to to wrap this thing up, because we've only got about 5-6 minutes here in this segment, what, in your mind, what is the best thing that we can do to ensure that in the future our votes actually do get counted in the United States?
Number one, vote. Make them steal it. Make them steal it. They're gonna jigger 5 million votes in the 2008, 4 million in 2006 this year.
They did 3 million last year. They did around 2 million in 2000.
And we got it down actually quite close to the numbers. I used to teach statistics, so I give you some hard numbers there. And let me tell you, so bring 6 million to the polls.
Yeah.
You know,
if they're gonna steal five,
right?
Bring six.
You know, it's one of the things Martin Luther King III said. They're gonna take your book, Greg, and put it on my father's grave, and he'll be very happy. And it was moving, but then I realized you get book dirty, man. Jesse Jackson said, well, let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, throw the book through the White House window. Yeah, I mean, but it's not just about elections. See, because and you know, once you steal the White House, what are you going to do with it? You know, and it's about shoplifting, then Mesopotamia, and the rest. That's why the book covers all the front lines in the class war here, from Iraq to Caracas.
Well, speaking of which, and let's get back to this. The book is Armed Madhouse by Greg Palaston. There's a marvelous chapter in it about how the election was stolen. So, you know, Kerry won, get over it, right? And, you know, John Kerry won. But you also cover a series of other topics in the book. Rather than my calling them out for you, since we don't have a whole lot of time, what do you consider to be the most important? What's your favorite here?
It's class work. You have to look at the whole point of this.
The reason why they steal elections is for class work.
Right. So, you know, you have, like, glued into the inside cover a secret history of the war over oil in Iraq. It got the secret documents for how they, you know, for the nuts out there who think that Bush had a secret plan to grab the oil fields of Iraq. It's not true, actually. I found out he had two plans. We got both of them.
Yeah.
It's very important to know how they're doing that. And you can't take that away from our next war, which we're having which you're going to have in Venezuela, not in Iran.
And they're setting that up right now.
That's why I have the chapter, the assassination of Hugo Chavez. And you can't disconnect that from from what happened in New Orleans and the games of electricity. I mean, I wrote a chapter there when Arnold got laid about the secret meetings between Ken Lay and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
That relates because Ken Lay was in those meetings with Dick Cheney in his bunker going over the oil maps of Iraq, the maps of Iraq's oil fields. Judicial Watch, the one thing they couldn't figure out is what they were discussing there. I was able to finally get someone who was involved in preparing those meetings to tell me what they were discussing, which you'll get in our Madhouse. And why Ken Lay, the Al Capone of electricity, was in a discussion on the maps of the oil fields of Iraq.
So Greg Palast, author of a new book, Our Armed Madhouse, and gregpalast.com. Of course, the book available anywhere, bookstores all over the United States, online, you know, your favorite bookstore, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Class warfare, the position that I've always taken is that the Republicans, if they were to simply tell the truth about what they're all about, let's have a small elite, small economic and religious elite rule the country. They could never get elected. And therefore, they have to steal elections. Therefore, they have to lie about what they're all about.
Right. And they have to keep the information away from you. That's the whole point. I mean, let's face it. All these reports, all these documents, all the secret inside stuff that you have in our madhouse from the September 11th documents to the elections to Ken Lay, you can watch on the British nightly news, but it is blocked here by the electronic Berlin Wall, and that's why I had to write a book.
Yeah, and this is where we started, and we just have 30 seconds left, but this is where we started our conversation, was the BBC, everybody in the world saw the theft of the 2000 and the 2004 elections, except nobody in America. How do we get this out to America?
Well,
tell everybody to buy Armed Madhouse.
Well, until Patriot Act 4, you can still read Armed Madhouse. I mean, but they are taking down your name, and we'll have the Armed Madhouse wing at Guantanamo next year. We could read it to each other. But that is important. Because if you shine the light on, you know, the cockroaches, turn on the light, cockroaches scatter to the wall. That's the key thing. We can't do this without the information.
This is the most important work in America right now, is waking people up, telling people to say, hey, read this, look at this, check this out. Go to commondreams.org and read that article. Go to gregpalast.com and read the article. Go to buzzsplash.com, you know, and so forth. And by the way, buy a copy of Armed Madhouse and share it with your friends. Pass it along. Greg Palast with us, gregpalast.com, the website. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, exposing the con and conservative.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I once was young and starry-eyed. Now I have these bittersweet memories. Songs were long and gas was cheap. No cell phones and water was free. Daddy paid and I never had to worry.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just looking at Greg Palast's schedule here. This Thursday, he'll be in Seattle. On Wednesday, he's going to be in Berkeley and Santa Rosa, California. Tomorrow, he'll be in San Francisco. Tonight, he's in Portland. If you're in any of those cities, you can check it out. You can find it all over at gregpalast.com. Going on to Chicago on Sunday, June 11th, Washington, D.C., the 12th. He'll be in New York, the 13th and 14th. Then Boulder, Denver, Albuquerque, Austin, Houston, Columbus, Albany, Atlanta, Tampa, and London, England. So check it out. Caitlin Saposi Belknap is with us right now. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Caitlin's website is votelocalcontrol.org. She's the campaign manager for the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, a group running Measure T. Caitlin, what is Measure T?
Measure T is a county ballot initiative. It's on the ballot in Humboldt County, California, where I live. And Measure T will, when it passes tomorrow, it will prohibit non-local corporations from contributing money to political campaigns in Humboldt County.
Now, your hope, I know, is not just to do this in Humboldt County, right? This is sort of a template for America?
Right. Well, we live here in Humboldt, so we're starting it here, but we have every intention of helping other communities pass similar laws so that we can take our democracy back from corporate America.
This is votelocalcontrol.org, the website, Caitlin's website. And Caitlin, so I, living here in Portland, for example, where I live, if we were to pass a resolution similar to your Measure T, or a law, actually, this is a law, not a resolution.
That's right, it's a law.
Okay, so if we were to pass a law similar to the Measure T law that you are proposing for Humboldt County, where, by the way, we're on the air on KGOE there in Humboldt County. If we were to propose a law like that here in Portland, and, for example, we just had city council elections 2 weeks ago, and one of the candidates was heavily funded by PGE, Portland General Electric, which is owned by, I mean, they're making a transition out of it, but is owned by Enron. You know, it's so that under Measure T, that corporation, Enron, would not be able to come in and throw money at candidates for that office. Is that my understanding correct?
Right, that's right. I mean, we talked a bit as we were writing the law about doing a ban on all corporate contributions, but what we decided is that local businesses, since they hardly ever contribute to local elections, and when they do, it's in very small amounts, that we would just prohibit non-local corporations. But we have a really narrow definition of local, which would mean that any corporation owned by another corporation, so in the case of what you just described, that would not be a local corporation, and you would that candidate would have to get their money from local people, not from a big corporation that obviously has an agenda, and that's why they're backing a candidate.
Right. Now, what's to, oh, and by the way, I would add, a local corporation or a local business, local company would probably be more likely on an issue, say, for example, that a Walmart's trying to come into town, and there's all this lobbying to bring the Walmart into town by the pro-Walmart, you know, the local developer, who's actually the local developer, you know, is going to make some money on it. And so he's running ads, and the local guy who paves parking lots, he's going to make some money on it. And the guy who runs the construction, you know, there are people who are local people who have an interest in seeing a Walmart come in. But a lot of your local retailers would not have an interest in seeing Walmart come in, so I would think that you would want them to be able to advertise against Walmart coming in, for example.
Right. Part of why we're running this is to protect local businesses and to protect our local economy. We actually, in 1999 in Eureka, saw a ballot initiative that was entirely financed by Walmart Corporation. They spent $235,000 when it was all said and done to try and change the zoning laws in the city of Eureka. Now, luckily, they were fought off. However, citizens on the other side had to organize tremendous amounts of money and time in order to do that when it was something that never would have been on the ballot if Walmart hadn't paid petitioners to put it there.
We're talking with Caitlin Saposi Belknap, and the website is votelocalcontrol.org. She's the campaign manager for the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, the group running Measure T. Caitlin, how much, what, but let me back up a little bit. What would prevent a company from coming in and finding some of their natural constituents? Let's use the example of Walmart, just since we've set up that as an example to continue with it. What if they came in and they said, okay, there's the guy who owns the local construction company or the local developer or the guy that we're going to buy the land from at an inflated price or whatever. You know, there are people who are local citizens. We'll just give each one of them $100,000 or $500,000 and let them buy the local advertising. What prevents that?
Well, the law prohibits direct or indirect contributions from non-local corporations. So that would be an indirect contribution, and that money could be traced back. And if there's any reason to believe that it came from a corporation, then it could be investigated just like any other law violation. And if it was found to have come from them, then that would actually be an infraction against the law.
That's nice and tidy.
Yeah, we tried to make it nice and tidy.
So, and do you place any kind of campaign limits on or spending limits on what local people can do?
No, it's not a spending limit ordinance, you know, that has come up a little bit here locally, but what we see it as is it's an ordinance that will protect local control, and I'm sure that Tom Hartman listeners know about all kinds of other ways that we need to move forward to reform our elections. And, you know, we see this as the first step in Humboldt County. And from there, we can, you know, do more.
Great, great. And people can learn about this at votelocalcontrol.org. Caitlin, how did this get started? How did you do this in your community? And how can people in other communities, we have people listening all across the United States, all over the world for that matter, how can people in local communities do what you've done?
Well, we're running this law mostly because in 2003 and 2004, Axiom Corporation, which is a Texas-based holding company that owns one of our local timber companies, financed a recall of our district attorney, and because he had sued them for fraud. And so our side had to organize thousands of hours of volunteer time, hundreds of thousands of dollars. When it was all said and done, their side had spent $300,000, our side had spent $250,000, and we had just elected this person to office 3 months before. So we came together to do something that would protect ourselves from that instance and what had happened with Walmart. And we would be happy to share the law with anybody, and we would also be happy to come to any community and do presentations. I work for an organization, Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, that does national workshops nationally and to try and help communities take back our democracy at the local level, because that's really where we have our power. And so we would encourage people to contact us, and we'd be happy to help you. We really want this to spread like wildfire and fire. And part of why we picked this issue is even though, and mostly it was because it was relevant to our community and we had seen these fights that we didn't want to have to fight again, but also this is an issue that, you know, as you said, in Portland, you have an example of a candidate being backed by a corporation. This is happening all over the country, that corporations are using the political process to push their agenda on communities. And communities have to stand up and do something about it. We have to put a stop to it. And we also have to challenge the idea that corporations have First Amendment rights, because if we allow that, then our legal system is corrupted and we won't be able to stand up for ourselves. So
which
that's
raises,
what the intention of this law is.
Which raises the question, if Measure T is passed, and the vote on this is tomorrow in California, is it not?
That's right.
So particularly if you live in Humboldt County, be sure to vote tomorrow. And if this is passed, will it pass a constitutional test?
Well, we think that it's about time that we challenge the idea that corporations have rights. But we also wrote our law so that it should fall within the exception of the Bilotti case, which is the case where the Supreme Court overturned a Massachusetts law that limited corporate involvement in ballot initiatives. And that what they said is that communities would have a right to pass a law like that as long as the reason was because corporate involvement was undermining citizen confidence in elections or causing the perception of corruption. And we did a poll of registered voters here in Humboldt County, and we found that 78% of Humboldt voters believe that corporate contributions make political corruption more likely. So we're prepared to have a legal battle if that's necessary, but we also refuse to acknowledge, and in the law, we have refused to acknowledge the idea that corporations have rights.
Hmm. So you're really getting the best of both worlds here. You're starting the discussion, and you're passing a law that will limit corporations from involving them, out-of-state corporations or out-of-region corporations, from involving themselves in the local political process at the same time. I mean, it's just, this is marvelous.
Right. The discussion in our community has been really exciting. I mean, we've had Chamber of Commerce members now asking for a $500 limit because they don't want to go so far as Measure T, but they recognize that something is needed. And so no matter what happens, we're going to have success because we've changed our community, and we've changed people's idea of what's politically possible in this community.
Begun changing the dialogue. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Caitlin Saposi-Belknap. She's the campaign manager for the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, for the group running Measure T. Their website, votelocalcontrol.org. Caitlin, we just have a couple of seconds left. Is votelocalcontrol.org the best website for people to find out information about you if they want to do what you're doing?
Yes, that's the best place to go. It has the full text of the law, lots of information, videos from forums that we've done. It's all there, and you can contact us through that website. And if people don't have Internet access, they can always call us at 707-444-0407.
Give it again.
707-444-0407.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, campaign manager for the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, pushing Measure T. It's, if you're in California, you can vote on it tomorrow. If you're in Humboldt County, votelocalcontrol.org. The website, it's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's head on down the road to somewhere. I gotta go, you don't know how it feels. You don't know how it feels.
And welcome back, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you. The American Bar Association's Board of Governors this weekend voted unanimously, quote, to investigate whether President Bush has exceeded his constitutional authority in reserving the right to ignore more than 750 laws that have been enacted since he took office, end quote. Amazing. And yet, at the same time, the Republicans in the Senate think something else is important. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Ellen, the bureau chief there. Hey, Ellen.
Well, not only are they going with gay marriage, they're going, I mean, they're really worried about the elections because they're going with the estate tax. That's one of the other things they're doing. I mean, they are really, they're going with the flag amendment. It's like, what is going on here?
It's Republicans gone wild.
They're desperado. Desperado.
I just have this picture of Frist and Hastert and all these guys pouring beer on each other. You know, it's in tight T-shirts or something. It's like they've run amok.
It's
not the best picture you want to have in your mind, is it?
Interesting, because Harry Reid, who, as you know, is a Mormon, said, what is the United States Senate going to debate this week? A new energy policy? No. Will we debate the raging war in Iraq? No. Will we address our staggering national debt? No. Will we address the series of global warming? No. Will we address rising crime statistics? No. Will we debate our country's trade imbalance? No. Stem cell research? No. We are spending most of the week on a constitutional amendment that will fail by a large margin.
And would be only the second time in the history of the United States that the Constitution had been amended to say no, rather than we'll protect you, we're going to prohibit you. It's this and prohibition.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean it's amazing. Anyway,
I'd like to get your opinion on this. Do you think that, I mean, the Republicans did a political calculus with Terry Schiavo, and they had to have been doing internal polling, and they came to the conclusion that it was such an important deal, that it would be such a help for them in the elections, that George W. Bush got up in the middle of the night and flew from Crawford, Texas, up to Washington, D.C. to sign this legislation, that they brought people back. I mean, it was a huge, big deal for Terry Schiavo, and it blew up in their faces. Is this attack And because I think most Americans see this as simply naked bigotry, attack on gays. Is this
well, you know, somebody answers this thing. I actually wrote an article for the right-wing World Net Daily, basically saying exactly that you know, the right, they're upset. The right is upset that Bush has essentially gone after immigration in the way he has, et cetera, and that they're going to wise up to where the president is on all this. And you know what? That's exactly the kind of email I got. They were 3-1. I got stuff today saying from people, look, you hit it on the head. I don't agree with you, but he's just pandering. And they see it for what it is. They're so out of touch. It's amazing.
So the question is Joe Sixpack going to see it for what it is?
Well, some of these guys are Joe Sixpack, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the people that write me, oh, my gosh, if you want some entertaining email, I ought to read you what I get every week. Yeah. These people are from Whackbird Heaven.
Yeah, Whackbird Heaven. I love it. Yeah, I guess I'll have to write for some Whackbird
Heaven. Anyhow, as we speak now, Greg is in the other room. We have Levice at the White House. Greg is in the other room actually listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even listen.
To the Senate debate, you mean?
Well, and no, this isn't the Senate debate. This is the president's speech on gay marriage.
Oh, he's giving it right now as we speak.
He's giving it right now as we speak. And what's amazing about all this is that Tony Snow sort of slipped and said something about civil rights. And then April Ryan at the White House, who is African-American from the American Urban Radio Network, said, are you comparing taking away of rights to civil rights? And then Tony backtracked on that. This is not, unless they play their cards totally correctly, and they've never been known to do that on issues like this, this is going to be pretty darn interesting.
It just seems, my sense of it is it's going to blow up in their face. I think Americans increasingly are saying, hey, you know, this is a civil rights issue. You know my thoughts on it. In any case, it's we have just a couple of, about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
On. What else is going on in Washington?
The Supreme Court today rejected an appeal from these news organizations who wanted to protect the confidential sources. This has to do with the Wenho Lee case, mm-hmm. where rather than give up their confidential sources, they actually joined the government. This is a settlement. It was $1.6 million, about half of it paid from five news organizations, the other half paid by the government for saying things about him that were actually not true. But the journalists didn't want to give up their cases in the civil suit, and so they decided to go in with their news organizations, New York Times, et cetera, and pay Wenho Lee.
In the libel case.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court is not touching that.
Does that mean that the Supreme Court is essentially saying, okay, we're going to make it more difficult for news organizations to keep private sources and not be penalized?
Well, I mean, we'll have to look at some analysis about that. It just came out, and I'm not a brilliant constitutional lawyer. I think it could go either way. I think this is, you know, this is the Supreme Court that sometimes likes to go away from any kind of really tough challenge, and so they just often let a lower court stand on something, and they just get out of it. And the other thing that's going on is the president is, as you know, going to be taking a trip to Vienna and Kiev June 20th and to 22nd. This is an EU meeting. And guess what? A lot of reporters aren't going because they said he doesn't make news.
He doesn't make news?
Right. So a lot of people are saying, we're just not spending the money.
Interesting.
We'll get the feed off the White House malt.
There you go. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you for being
here. You got
it. Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Next, your daily headlines from Iraq. And we'll be taking your calls, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. And global warming, irrelevancies, somehow I doubt it. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And time now to, since we are living in a time of military occupation in Iraq, to examine what's going on.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Our developments from Iraq today compiled by Reuters. Gunmen in police uniforms abducted up to 50 employees of various Baghdad transport companies on Monday. In Suwayara, four bodies with stab wounds were found in the Tigris River. In Bakaba, gunmen shot dead the bodyguard of a local official and the bodyguard's father and brother in the city of Bakaba. In Baghdad, Iraqi army forces raided four targets in central Baghdad and killed a financier in bankrolling insurgent activities. Also in Baghdad, Iraqi forces captured two al-Qaeda militants. The army in Mosul arrested, the Iraqi army arrested 22 suspects. In Basra, the Iraqi army arrested four men and confiscated weapons. Near Fallujah, police found the body of a man who had been shot and tortured. In Baghdad, Iraqi forces killed one, quote, terrorist, end quote, and detained three others. In other political developments, three suspects in the murder of a British Iraqi aid worker, Margaret Hassan, in 2004, were due to stand trial in an Iraqi court. And the trial of Saddam Hussein and seven co-accused for crimes against humanity resumed in Baghdad today, with more defense witnesses taking the stand. With regard to the hostages, here's the bottom line story here. An Iraqi Interior Ministry official denied on state television report that four Russian embassy employees kidnapped in Baghdad had been released. They're apparently still held in custody. Meanwhile, 55 foreign hostages have been reported executed by their captors, 41 in 2004, 13 in 2005, and one in 2006. And then General John Batiste went on CNN Late Edition with Wolf Blitzer and came out and said the unsayable, which is that the massacre, the apparent massacre at Haditha, the evidence apparently, I would say that the evidence has reached the point where we can't say that, even, certainly there has not been a trial, and I get all that, and I'm all in favor of due process, and I still think O.J. killed her. Right? I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, we're entitled to an opinion. My opinion, based on everything I've seen, is that something terrible happened there. That we're looking at another My Lai situation when you've got the wife of one of the soldiers who were there saying that these guys were all doing drugs and totally stressed out, and some of them on their third tour of duty. And John Batiste coming out and saying, okay, this needs to be laid at the feet of Don Rumsfeld, period, right there. And this guy, and Don Rumsfeld should resign because he's responsible for what happened in Haditha. And, here he is, just with Wolf Blitzer.
I, however, see a direct link between Haditha, the national embarrassment of Abu Ghraib, going on 4 years now of uncontrollable chaos in Iraq, with the bad judgment, poor decisions of our Secretary of Defense back in late 2003 and 2004.
There you go. There's a direct connection. Haditha, Abu Ghraib, and Don Rumsfeld all rolled together. In fact, I would say that Alberto Gonzalez's torture memos and Don Rumsfeld's torture memos and Dick Cheney's involvement all contributed to this. And now we hear that over the objections of the State Department, the Pentagon and the White House want to change the language in the Army manual to say you humiliating, degrading customers, detainees or captives of war, prisoners of war. That's fine. No problem. Which is, of course, going to mean that if we're changing the rules of the Geneva Convention, everybody else will change the rules of the Geneva Convention. General John Batiste says he just ain't buying it.
I question his competency, and I speak for the American people. We deserve accountability.
When he says his competency, by the way, he's referring to Don Rumsfeld. Then Blitzer asks him,
what specifically did he do wrong, in your opinion? We went to war with his plan alone.
And this is what has these generals fried, is that they had come up with a plan to go to war in Iraq that probably would have worked. I mean, it still wouldn't have been a good war. It still wouldn't have been a justified war, but at least it would have worked. But not only did Bush and Rumsfeld lie us into a phony war, but then they did it incompetently. Incompetence is something that generals in the military just really don't have much tolerance for.
He all but ignored the U.S. Central Command's hard work to develop a strategy that would have worked in Iraq, that would have accounted for the hard work to build the peace and stop the insurgency. We should have deployed with up to 380,000 coalition troops in addition to the Iraqi security forces to establish security in that country, to secure the borders with Iran and Syria, to intimidate the insurgent. We went in under-resourced, overcommitted.
And it was Don Rumsfeld's fault. So, our Iraq report for the day. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Sacramento, California, you want to share with us the official Republican meme whenever Republican theft of elections gets brought up?
Well, I'm just getting frustrated because this is a subject that I am quite interested in. And all I hear is what you... Okay, this latest thing with Ohio and purging of the rolls. Okay, it's not that we're cheating. The rolls need to be cleaned up every few years to make sure...
No, I'm sorry. It's that the Republicans are cheating, Jeff.
Okay.
Go back and read the article. Go to RollingStone.com and read the article by Bobby Kennedy. And if you think you can take that thing apart, call me back and we'll go over it.
It has nothing to do with us cheating. We're not trying to cheat. We're just trying to make sure...
Who's the we you're talking about? Republicans?
Huh?
Who's the we you're referring to?
Well, okay, I must say, I only know California. Okay, in California, there's people on the rolls that have been there for years that should not be on the roll. But there's no way to take them off because... Every effort that we have tried to use to clean the roads in California that democratically controlled legislators have blocked.
Oh, I know. And the first Republican priority has to be to reduce the number of people on the election rolls. I understand that. I understand that. As Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist, said to a group of Republicans in a church about 15 years ago when they first started implementing this strategy.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So as the Republican crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors, the treasonous, traitorous acts of Ken Blackwell and other Republicans and Ken Melman and Terry Holt and George W. Bush in Ohio and other states comes to light, the Republicans are going to use this as an opportunity to try and pass more laws that will further disenfranchise voters and reduce the number of total voters. Right, Jeff?
But the solution is to get more Democrats to stay on the rolls legitimately. But when you get people that are not on the rolls legitimately, it got to be cleaned out so that the voting process can be fair and legitimate. The way it is being done now, no IDs to check.
Jeff, I would submit to you that for every person who votes illegitimately, that is, every person who is, for example, an illegal alien. I know that's the thing that you're all hysterical about.
No, illegal aliens is a major part, but I'm talking about just illegitimate.
Well, let me just finish this sentence. For every person who illegitimately votes, who goes through all the work and effort of showing up at the polling places and digging through that ballot and casting a vote, for every single one of those illegitimate voters, there's at least 10 and probably 50 people who tried to vote legitimately and have every legitimate right to vote, and their right to vote was eliminated by Republicans caging these lists and purging these lists.
I believe that's true, though, Tom, and I don't see where they have the right to legitimately vote if they don't follow the process that they have to do to remain.
I'm sorry, Jeff. If they haven't followed the process, they're not on the voting rolls. It's just that simple. Mike in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Mike, we have about a half a minute. What's up?
I want to talk about this subject.
Not on a cell phone, not on a speakerphone, please.
That's fine. No, I'm not on a speakerphone anymore.
Okay. What's up?
We need to go around this thing, okay? There's no way in the world we're going to change all this mess. And the thing to do is to come up with a system that is acceptable to everyone, that can be proven to be absolutely correct, and tell them to go stick it. I mean, you know, we can't fix what they've got. We need to just go around them.
Who's the them you're talking about?
The current voting system is a fraud.
Hmm. Yeah, well, Mike, I'm telling you, the current voting system, I don't disagree with you. It's being gamed big time. Although here in Oregon, it's really interesting. We have vote by mail. It works. We have high voter participation. I mean, we had like 80% in the election before last. It was fairly low in this last election, but I think that was because there was just massive negative advertising, which, of course, we know suppresses the vote. But I think that there are options that can be done. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest. We have Bob Fitrakis with freepress.org on the line. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Oh, glad to be on.
Bob, you and Harvey Wasserman have done some of the most seminal research into the theft of the 2004 election in the state of Ohio. The Free Press, of course, based out of Columbus, Ohio. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote this, what I consider to be a brilliant piece in Rolling Stone magazine. Came out on Thursday, Friday of last week. And immediately, bang, within 24 hours, Salon.com had a rebuttal piece saying, oh, no, the election wasn't stolen. And here's why. And in fact, over at Think Progress, tragically, and I would encourage all of my listeners to let the folks at the Center for American Progress know their opinions on this. My opinion is that I'm very, very disappointed. Over at Think Progress, they put it up on their blog at thinkprogress.org, essentially taking the position of Salon, saying that or endorsing it. Now, you've done some research into the Salon's debunking of Kennedy.
Sure, and you know, the errors in the Salon piece are, I mean, they're just massive. It's clearly somebody, you know, who's never been, appears not to have ever been in Ohio, has no knowledge of Ohio politics, wasn't on the ground, and suddenly they're experts. You know, these people ought to try something. It's under ORC 14943. It's called a public records request. The only conclusion I could come to is they had a pre-existing position from an ideological perspective, perhaps from the center or as debunkers of those of us challenging the election, and they just simply created the facts as needed. I mean, there's glaring errors in the Salon piece. For example, they completely mix up the role of William Anthony and Matt Damschroeder and make William Anthony the Democrat in charge of the machine allocation, which is just nonsense.
So, should, in your opinion, does the Kennedy piece withstand scrutiny?
Oh, the Kennedy, here's the big difference. You know, the Kennedy people in Rolling Stone, I had two different fact checkers calling me. I checked my calendar since February 20th. I also looked at their emails where there was over two dozen emails where they wanted corrections, and they left a lot of stuff out. Salon, which turned their piece around in, you know, 24 hours, did not check one fact that I know, and virtually every fact that I check of theirs is wrong or slanted and interpreted in a way that I would expect from Fox News or Karl Rove at the White House.
Then why would the Center for American Progress highlight this?
Well,
I mean, they don't have a dog in this fight, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, here's my position.
Salon, this guy, right. Fareed Manjoo, or whatever his name is, has published previously a piece saying that, you know, Bush didn't steal the election. So he had, you know, his reputation to maintain.
Well, I suspect the dog in the fight is the deliberate attempt by the DNC not to come to the conclusion that the election is stolen, even though their own research indicates much of the same stuff that Bobby Kennedy went on record is. I mean, they do one of the bizarrest things in history in the DNC report, is they kind of go, you know, yeah, the Free Press is right. Yeah, Mark Crispin Miller is right. Yeah, Tom Hartman is right. You know, and Greg Palast is right. And then they go, but, you know, All these things are true, but all those remaining uncounted votes and those people suppressed, they would have probably split 50-50. And what they know, and this is so cynical, what they know is that those people that are being repressed and their votes not being counted deliberately by Republican operatives are from the inner cities of Cleveland that voted 12-1 for Kerry. They're from Akron that voted 7-1 for Kerry. They're from Toledo that voted 7-1 for Kerry. So, I mean, it's political science 101, and that's what my PhD is in. So it's some of the most cynical attempts to avoid the truth that the election was stolen. And not only that, on a personal level, you know, I had people in the Democratic Party pleading with me. They're saying, look, you know, why hang Bill Anthony out to dry? I mean, he delivered Franklin County 54-46. You know, can you protect him? So a lot of it is this sort of internal protecting of the Democratic Party professional apparatus.
This is sort of get along, go along?
Sure.
Amazing. We just have 30 seconds or so here. We're talking with Bob Fitrakis, freepress.org, the website. Bob, how can we get this story out into the mainstream? What's the best way, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, the blogs are on fire with it, but we also have got to call in shows. I know your show has been incredible at digging up the facts from the beginning. And really, I think we battle back with the facts and what Kennedy did. You know, the big difference between Kennedy and Solana is Kennedy and Rolling Stone actually footnoted everything and put it out there, which greatly advances the debate. But I also have a book coming out in the fall which deals with nothing but public records. And
that's
you know,
great.
I think that's what we got.
Real quickly, a website for that, Bob?
Freepress.org, but it's going to be the New Press. It'll be coming out of the New Press.
Okay, but there'll be links to it from freepress.org.
Sure.
Great. Bob Fitrakis over at freepress.org. Bob, thanks for the great work you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
Please keep it up. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. I'm the decider.
I figured that it couldn't be too difficult.
Do I hear the voices?
To be president of the USA.
I read the front page, and I know the speculation.
I saw my dad do it. How hard could it be? Then the office finally came to me. Now I'm in control. I'm the decider.
But I'm the decider.
That's my role. Not a doubt in my mind.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm always right. I'm the decider. I don't do all-nighters. That's not me.
That's how I work. I'm the decider.
People seem to think that it takes brains and stuff.
I don't know why you say that.
But hey, nuclear physics, this is not.
See, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case.
Anyone could do it. Harry, Dick, or Tom. The hardest part's deciding where to bomb.
I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
But that's my job.
Oh, yeah, he's the decider. And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Sarah Van Gelder is with us. She's the editor, the executive editor of Yes Magazine, and the co-founder as well of Yes Magazine. The website, yesmagazine.org, and if you want to read Sarah Van Gelder's blog over there, just go to yesmagazine.org/svgblog. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
I am just great, but I'll get better. Welcome to the program. I hope all is well with you.
Just great, yeah.
Good. Healthcare for all. This the theme of the fall issue of Yes Magazine. This was also a topic for MoveOn.org recently.
That's right. They voted it the most important topic of all the issues that they want MoveOn to take on. So, yeah, we're going to be looking at the question of corporate health care. You know, it's the remarkable thing about corporate health care is that it's making pretty much everybody unhappy.
Well, except for Bill Frist and his family.
That's right. There's a few people who are making out like bandits because they happen to have a big corporate interest in the amount of money that's flowing into their pockets. But apart from them, doctors are unhappy with it. A lot of hospitals are. Certainly nurses are, patients, whether they're insured or uninsured. You know, about half of the bankruptcies in the United States now are caused by medical crises, and that includes a lot of people who actually have insurance.
Right. In fact, I think about half of the bankruptcies are caused by medical problems, and half of those people had insurance. Is that, am I remembering my numbers right?
I don't know about the second bit, but it sounds right. Yeah.
So when in your overview piece of health insurance for Yes Magazine, the fall issue of Health Mag, is the fall issue coming up?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the upcoming fall issue. What have you learned that you'd want to share with our listeners that they probably don't know?
Well, first of all, that a lot of countries are doing way better than we are on all sorts of indicators of well-being and health. Certainly the standard ones of infant mortality and longevity, we're way down the list on those categories, even though we're spending way more money than those other countries are. So there's a lot of opportunity for improvement, I think, is the big news, and that all around the country there are states that are looking at universal health care in various kinds of ways, and there's a national movement, and physicians are right at the forefront of that national movement calling for single-payer health care system. So I think this may be one of those windows of opportunity. I think that there's enough discontent now with the corporate system where even employers, even major employers, are starting to see that they can't continue to cough up these big health care premiums, and they can't really leave their employees out in the lurch either. So I think this is one of those moments when there's actually enough political momentum for change that something could happen.
Isn't it amazing, Sarah Van Gelder, that right now Bill Frist, whose father is worth an estimated $3 billion as a result of buying up formerly public hospitals when the laws changed in various states to allow this, buying them up, flipping them private, wringing the money out of the hospitals and the people, and putting it in his own pocket. His daddy a billionaire, his brother a billionaire, he himself a multi-hundred millionaire, all from health care. That while 80%, more than 80% of Americans, or a very large percentage of Americans, you probably have the exact numbers, believe that we should have a single payer healthcare system, a system that basically cuts the Bill Frists and Tom Frists out of the business. Bill Frist is standing in front of the Senate, probably as we speak, saying, "We're not going to talk about healthcare. The really important issue in the United States is whether gays can marry."
Well, that's very familiar. You know, of course, Bush was talking about that, and the Republicans were talking about that right before the election last time, and then dropped it as soon as the election happened and tried to privatize Social Security. So, yeah, it's a great issue for distracting people, but I think Americans are getting a little bit more savvy to that now. And, again, on a state and local level, even though nationally we've got a fairly corrupt Congress that, you know, it doesn't seem to be able to extract itself from the pharmaceutical industries and the big corporate medical plans. On the state and local level, there's a lot more activity going on, and I think one of these days the federal government's going to have to get out of the way and let people have a decent health care system in the country.
The thing that concerns me even more than the corruption of government is the corruption of the media. There are millions and tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by the big pharmaceutical companies advertising their products on national television, and therefore, it seems, national television will not have a discussion about national health care or about the corruption within the health care system. It just doesn't happen. It's not the subject of investigative reporting in you know, Dateline 60 Minutes kind of programs. It's not the subject of just routine reporting on evening news programs. It never shows up in the storylines of sitcoms and stories. People don't get sick. They don't deal having to deal with medical bankruptcies. I mean, just it's as if you were to watch TV 24/7 for a month, I think that you would still come to the conclusion, or somebody living outside the United States watching American television, you'd come to the conclusion that there is absolutely no problem at all with our healthcare system. Everything is perfect. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, and we know that that's not true. 18,000 people die every year because of being uninsured and not having access to the medical care they need. So we know that this is a huge, huge issue. And you know, I think you're right about the self-censorship, because we've been doing a lot of research trying to find out, okay, where are the really good articles that are out there on this topic and on what's being done about it? And what we're not finding is much reporting about all this grassroots effort and national effort to get a different kind of a healthcare system. It's very underreported. So that's one of the main things we're going to focus on. Is we've actually commissioned some articles to do a wrap-up on just what is going on at the state level, what is going on at the local level, and at the national level.
We're talking with Sarah Van Gelder, yesmagazine.org, the website, SVG blog at the end of yesmagazine.org if you want to check out her blog. Sarah, also in the fall issue, you have an article on climate change. The hurricane season is upon us now. It officially opened last week. What are you in your reporting? What have you learned about this?
Well, we've been actually covering climate change for many years, almost since our beginning 10 years ago. And there's an incredible lack of leadership on the national level. But on the local level, by national level, I mean in terms of government. But on the local level, there's an alliance of mayors. There's 173 mayors in 37 states who have adopted the Kyoto Protocol. So they're working to get their own cities up to the Kyoto standards for greenhouse emissions. The Apollo Alliance is an example on a national level of a very interesting initiative that is crossing all sorts of political lines in terms of the support they're getting, because they're basically saying, you know, we can take on this issue as a national priority. We can provide millions of jobs. We can provide jobs that are long-term and family wage jobs. We can also deal with local pollution efforts, because when you invest in renewable energy and efficiency, you're investing in a much cleaner type of technology. So there's all these benefits that can be met, and at the same time we can be reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and becoming less of an international pariah. Because, you know, besides our foreign policy in the Middle East, I think the second most egregious error that the United States is making in its relations with other countries is not taking seriously what the rest of the world is starting to understand, which is the seriousness of climate change. And, of course, the United States is the biggest polluter per capita of any country in the world in terms of climate pollution.
We generate a quarter of the planet's CO2?
I believe that's right.
Opposition to the war, the final issue, the final topic here that I wanted to talk with you about. The recent massacre of civilians in Iraq, a growing understanding the toll it's taking on the U.S. military. Give me an overview here. What again, is Yes Magazine bringing to this?
We've just done an interview with Cindy Sheehan, and one of the things that is so striking about Cindy, who you may know, is her son was killed in Iraq a few weeks after he arrived there in the U.S. military. And certainly there's so many families that have experienced this kind of tragedy. The interesting thing, I think, about Cindy is that she...
Oh, pardon me. Excuse me. Continue.
Okay. She's chosen to take this question on and do everything within her power to try to prevent, everything nonviolent within her power, to prevent any other families from experiencing the tragedy and the grief that she's been going through. So she is just nonstop on this question. She's traveling around the world. She's speaking not only about this particular war, but about the whole question of war and the whole question of how war is being used to line the pockets of the military-industrial complex, and how it's the children of the poor and middle class that suffer. And this is, you know, her speaking this kind of truth with the kind of grief that she's just experienced is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, it truly is. And when she spoke before John Conyers commission about, you know, what she learned that Bush wanted to go to war even before he was elected, even before he announced he was going to run for office, it was a pretty horrifying thing. Sarah Van Gelder. She's the executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.org, the website. Sarah, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great speaking with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Staring at the blank page before you. Open up the dirty window. Let the sun illuminate the world that you cannot find. Reaching for something in the distance. So close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions. Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS for all things Macintosh, all things iPod. Give them a shout and say hi. Welcome back to our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Over at thinkprogress.org, they're reporting yesterday, President Bush argued that the federal marriage amendment under consideration by the Senate this week would take the issue of marriage away from the courts and to the people. Here's what Bush said. He said, a constitutional amendment will put a decision that is critical to American families and American societies in the hands of the American people, which is exactly where it belongs. Democracy, not court order, should decide the future of marriage in America. It sounds like there's a certain amount of logic to that. I mean, this is a sort of kind of semi-logical argument that the Bushies make. But law professor Michael Seidman, at an event at the Center for American Progress, said, no, sorry, not the case. He said if enacted, their handiwork, this federal marriage amendment, is bound to produce outcomes that no one could have wanted or intended, and an unprecedented transfer of power over domestic relations to federal judges. Clearly, he said, the framers of the amendment mean to distinguish between marriage itself and its, quote, legal incidents, end quote. This much is obvious because the first sentence defines only marriage, while the second sentence refers to both marriage and its legal incidents. Apparently, the framers of this anti-gay marriage amendment have in mind a distinction between core legal attributes, which make up marriage, and an unspecified list of peripheral attributes which make up its legal incidents. Because the amendment is entirely silent about what is core and what is periphery, it gives federal judges unchecked power to place various aspects of marriage in one category or another. Sounds to me like what they are saying is that the federal marriage amendment that the Bushies are trying to push through could be interpreted, let's say it passed, and it's not going to pass the Senate, and let's say that three-quarters of the states ratified it, and that's not going to happen, but let's say that it actually became an amendment to the Constitution the way it's written. It seems to me like a federal judge could say, okay, you can't call it marriage, but you can call it civil unions. And, you know, we'll go with that. That'll be okay. This is, I'm telling you, this is getting, because this, that would be absolutely consistent with the Republicans saying one thing and doing another. It's like, you know, during the election in 2004, the Republicans were all over gay marriage, like white on rice, yelling and screaming about it, jumping up and down, we got to do something, we got to do something. As soon as the election's over, reporter asks George W. Bush, what about the gay marriage stuff? And he goes, well, that should be left up to the states. Now there's an election coming up again. Another year that ends with an even number. All of a sudden, Bush is all about gay marriage. But as is so often the case with Republicans, they're going to do it in a way that they keep it out there as a topic. So if they can pass a federal marriage amendment, that's good for another couple of election cycles. And then they get that. And then, with this law, oh, gee, we didn't realize that we wrote this thing in such a way that it allows for civil unions. So now we've got to do something about civil unions. They will figure out a way to beat up on gays. I'm telling you, they will figure out a way to beat them up no matter what, for as long as they can. Because, of course, the gays are responsible for 9/11. I mean, you just have to know that. I mean, in the Republican world, the gays are responsible for 9/11, and therefore, we've got to do this. You didn't know about that? Oh, yeah. Here, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson tell you all about it.
Man, this trial really copy of which expired on 04/28/2006.
To enter a serial number from the web store, click the Enter Serial button below.
To purchase the license, click the Purchase button below.
The thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
I totally concur, and the problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
And, of course, if we continue to allow gays to even exist, then God will allow the Muslims to hit us again, right, Jerry and Pat?
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Quickly, on while you're on that topic of gay marriage. So all the stories about Ada, or Ada that pulled off 9/11 supposedly, being in those strip joints with women, I never heard any story about him being in a gay bar.
No, well, there you go. At least he was heterosexual, right?
Well, so. I mean, you know, their story is just spun out, I think. But anyway, yeah. on to another issue about health care.
Yeah, you're going to have to make it real quick, Armin, because it's the end of the show.
The problem is we have corporate single payoff health care in this country. That's the problem. Corporate single payoff.
Yeah,
they pay off Congress.
Well said. They pay off Congress. Armin, you can do a soundbite when you need to, and I thank you for it. It's been well done. Coming up on tomorrow's program, I'll be asking conservative John Berlew, isn't the bigger issue of Enron really about when corporations rule America? CIA analyst Ray McGovern is going to tell us here that you can expect staged terrorist attacks by the Bushies, advancing the Bush plan to attack Iran. That and more, and your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get involved. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.